we left John Knox in Geneva with John Calvin some a couple of weeks ago, and I don't know if in the next, what do we got, 3 weeks, if we will get through Knox and the Covenanters before the holiday break. We'll see.
Do you resume after that?
If we don't get through, then we'll resume after that, and we'll just have to kind of refresh our memory and get back up to speed there.
Bill, did you say holiday break?
Is that, I don't know. Did I say something like that? Okay. Well, Knox was in Geneva with John Calvin, and that's where we left him before he ended up with at Frankfurt, and so in your notes, we'll be picking up with him in Frankfurt from 1554-1555. While he was in Geneva with Calvin, he did travel a bit during that time, always looking and listening for tidings of the affairs at home. And then on getting back to Geneva, he got an unexpected call to go to Frankfurt, Germany, and pastor the English-speaking church there. He wasn't sure whether he should, but Calvin urged him to go, saying it was the call of God. And this was a crucial point in his life, a crucial point in Reformation history. As Dr. Tate says, this period in Knox's life, lasting a mere 6 months, saw events whose repercussions can be felt even today. And his handling of those events highlighted particular facets of his character: his shrewdness, moderation, and tact, his lion-like defense of the faith, and his Puritanism. Well, the church there in Frankfurt had largely formed through the influence of William Whittington and his friends, who saw that there was a French-speaking church in Frankfurt, and that Frankfurt was an excellent merchant town, strategically placed as it was on trade routes running across Central Europe, and perched on the River Main, close to where it met the Rhine. He decided it would be the perfect place for an English-speaking church. So they invited all the scattered English exiles they could find in Zurich and Basel, Strasbourg, and other places to come to Frankfurt and establish an English-speaking church there, which they did. Now, it was largely because of Bloody Mary that there were so many English there in the first place. Well, the church was outside the parameters of both the Roman Church and the Church of England. It was independent. And so here in the summer of 1554 was established the very first nonconformist church in English history. And who did they choose to be their first pastor? The Scot John Knox. Well, the church needed a pastor. They needed a very good one, given their situation. Whittingham and others were admittedly too inexperienced to lead the fellowship, and so they asked John Knox, the Scot, to come and be their pastor. The English historian 100 years later puzzles over this strange thing. He says that so many able English divines that were then abroad, that a Scotsman should be pastor of the English church at Frankfurt. Well, he concludes that it was Knox's sheer superior ability that made him the obvious choice. This again underscores Knox's international character as well as his influence on English Puritanism. What happened there during his stay is very important, and it'd be good to remember. There were two key participants in this affair and one notable observer. The observer was a man who happened to be there at the time doing what he was usually doing, taking notes. Nice habit, taking notes. And this was a fellow named John Fox. Yes, the same Fox who wrote the Book of Martyrs and histories, or he's just taking notes. And at this time, he was compiling notes for his Book of Martyrs. The one participant was an Englishman who came after Knox was already there and caused quite a stir. And that was Dr. Richard Cox, which we met very briefly before, and we'll hear about him in a moment. But the other one, of course, was John Knox. So we may remember this situation in Frankfurt as the Fox, Knox, and Cox affair. And I suspect they may have worn socks. I don't know if they ate bagels and lox, or if they hunted fox, or anyway, the Fox, Knox, and Cox affair. Knox arrived in November of 1554. There was a minority there that wanted to use the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. Well, John, of course, did not agree with this, and the majority was with him, but in his tact, he didn't want to override their wishes by a vote at a church meeting, so he struck upon a compromise. He and Whittingham drew up an order of service that was somewhere between Calvin's Geneva service and the Anglican prayer book. It was called the Liturgy of Compromise. And it was well received by the congregation, and it averted unnecessary controversy. And of course, by drawing up this other liturgy, Knox was, in effect, repudiating the Anglican prayer book. But he didn't preach against it openly until he was forced to later. He simply didn't use it. In these things, he was a man of moderation. But then, Dr. Cox came to town. Richard Cox had been Chancellor of Oxford, Dean of Westminster, a church administrator under Henry VIII and Edward VI, and he had a hand in helping to write the prayer book. He was an able man and gifted. But he liked to throw his weight around, and he had the tact of a hurricane. Dr. Lloyd-Jones says that his behavior can only be described as quite abominable, intransigent, and rude. Well, Cox had been with this delicately balanced fellowship only 1 week before he loudly and violently insisted on using the Anglican prayer book. He insisted to Knox that, quote, they would do as they had done in England, and their church would have the face of an English church. And Knox very simply replied, the Lord grant that it would have the face of Christ's church. And here was the crux of the question. Knox was striving for unity. Cox was striving for uniformity. There's a difference. The Anglican way was the way of uniformity, where the Puritan way was striving for the way of unity. Well, Knox, who had been moderate about the prayer book until now, was forced by these circumstances now to speak openly against it. Cox used his influence to have him expelled and driven from Frankfurt, so he went back to Geneva. As Lloyd-Jones summarizes, the first attempt at a Puritan church amongst English people was that in Frankfurt. It was a failure because Cox and his friends resorted to the despicable resort of charging John Knox falsely with high treason against the emperor, the political judge. And they did succeed in running him off. Back to Geneva he went. What had failed in Frankfurt became a success in Geneva. Here's what happened. After Knox was treated so badly in Frankfurt, a number of the congregation were so grieved by that that they left Frankfurt as well and made their way to Geneva, led by William Whittingham. They were warmly welcomed by Calvin and settled there as an English congregation with John Knox as their pastor. Geneva was filled with so many exiles and refugees at this point from all over Europe that they had to share a church building with the Italian church. And just in just 10 years, the population of Geneva went from 13,000 to 20,000, and the biggest problem was finding out where to put everybody. It was a welcome haven for people looking for religious liberty, particularly of the Puritan sort, and so many of them came. What do you do with all these people? Became a logistical problem. Well, then in Geneva from 1555 to 1559, here Knox introduced his order of service that had been tried and rejected in Frankfurt. It became known as the Geneva Book. This Geneva order was not Calvin's order. He had his own order. It was primarily Knox's Book of Order, which he successfully used in Geneva, and he brought back with him to Scotland when the time came, and which had been the official order of the Church of Scotland ever since. So after the Frankfurt failure, it's here in Geneva that we have the first really Puritan English church. And it was pastored, again, by the Scot John Knox. Here's one of the most compelling reasons that we assert with Carlyle that John Knox is the founder of English Puritanism. When at its peak, the English church in Geneva numbered about 200 people. It was a rather remarkable cross-section of people. Dr. Tate lists some of the people who were worshiping there at the time. John Bodley, a princely merchant of Devon, and his young son Thomas, who was later the founder of the Bodleian Library at Oxford. The Earl of Bedford, Sir William Stafford, brother-in-law to Henry VIII's Queen Anne Boleyn. There was a boy called Nicholas Hilliard, later became a miniaturist portrait painter in the court of Queen Elizabeth. Harry Deuce, a bricklayer who was an open-air preacher in London, had suffered for the faith. And Miles Coverdale, who had encouraged William Tyndale in his translation of the Pentateuch after he had shipwrecked, and who himself was an able translator. They have a copy of Coverdale's Bible in the Trinity College Dublin in their library there. And I believe Reformed Seminary, Dr. Tate managed to snag one for Covenant Seminary to have a copy of Coverdale's Bible. It was here in Geneva, far from the political intrigues and games of the English court, far from the dangerous and bloody battles of Scotland, far from the arrogance and the bitterness of Frankfurt, that John Knox and his fellow Puritan exiles found the freedom to build on the New Testament principles of worship, work, government, and discipline. At long last, they could feel like Christ was truly the head of their church, that it would have the face not of an English church, not of a Scottish church, that it would have the face of Christ's church. They finally felt that they were free to biblically safeguard what they called the crown rights of the Redeemer in his church. And it was precisely this fellowship, it was precisely this prototype that was to serve as a model to be followed for the newly reformed congregations of Scotland, in the Puritan congregations of England, and then through the pilgrims of the Mayflower in the churches in the New World here. So we're really not exaggerating when we call John Knox the father of English Puritanism. Last time we mentioned in passing the importance of the continent sojourn for English Puritanism, that the difference in perspective gained by those who had visited the continent was a key factor in the growth of Puritanism. Here they had the freedom to go back to the scriptures and to try to develop a truly reformed church order, doctrine and practice, liturgy, discipline, authority structure, the works. We have a little trouble identifying with the significance of that. You see, we, in one sense, we've not known anything else. But it may be a little hard for us to relate to the Church of England experience, where you have a state church totally regulated from above, where dissension is not tolerated, and where you're a member just by being born there. You don't have to do anything to get in. You have to do something to get out. But that is what these people had to look back to in England. So this freedom in Geneva to worship as they felt the scriptures would have them worship was an extremely important formative influence for them. Because you see, it's with that taste in their mouths that they returned to England after Bloody Mary's death and sought then to reform their own church in England. And it was that taste of freedom and reformation on the continent which gave much of the impetus to the Puritan movement, which we'll look at later. Well, all the while that Knox was abroad, he had his ear to the ground for tidings of his homeland. His heart was always in Scotland, though he was prepared to be useful wherever he found himself. It's kind of a good attitude to have. He finally got the chance to return at a crucial time. James V died, you remember, and before long, his widow, Mary of Lorraine, the French Queen Regent, the mother of Mary, Queen of Scots, had placed Frenchmen in many high places, in many high offices in Scotland, and openly and freely used French troops. She wanted to turn Scotland into a French satellite, and the national sentiment was deeply offended at this. Then in March of 1558, Walter Milne, an old and well-loved minister of 82, was martyred. And this kind of brought the pot to a boil and set the stage for the rebellion that was to come. When Knox returned on May the 2nd, 1559, he was looked to as the natural one to rescue Scotland from this tyranny and really from this treason. Well, he was called upon to play two roles at this point, for both of which he was admirably suited. First, he was a clear and forceful preacher of the Word of God, and he rose to this task with skill and abandon. He's famous for being an animated and a lively preacher, of which one of his students said that he thought he was going to beat the pulpit to pieces. Something like shiver it to blads or some such expression. But secondly, he was a shrewd and talented politician with an instinctive insight into the heart of the matter. So he played an immediate and crucial part in the great events of 1559-1560. Even before Knox had arrived, the Protestant Party had become a well-organized and well-armed group and were called the Congregation. When John stepped ashore at Leith, the port in Edinburgh, the Queen Regent happened to be away in Glasgow, and the Roman bishops were holding a conference there in Edinburgh. Well, they were afraid to dare arrest him without the Queen Regent there. Well, later they wished they had. Knox wrote to a friend in London then, saying that he was, quote, uncertain as yet what God shall further work in this country, except that I see the battle shall be great, for Satan rageth even to the uttermost. And I am come, I praise my God, even in the brunt of the battle. It wasn't long before the strength of the forces of the Congregation took the Queen Regent's forces by surprise. They used intense guerrilla warfare, and within a year they gained control of the country. Knox traveled around with the forces, encouraging them by his preaching. He preached again in St. Andrew's Cathedral, which he had, you remember, he had predicted that he would do back when he was chained in that French galley. His preaching often put fresh heart and courage in the people who were in the midst of a very difficult struggle. Well, it was only really with the help of Queen Elizabeth of England that they finally won. While he had been in England Knox had become friends with a fellow named William Cecil, who by now was Elizabeth's counselor. Well, it was by Cecil's influence that money was sent, and finally a strong fleet sailing up the Firth of Forth that completely demoralized the Queen Regent's forces. Finally, in June of 1560, Mary died, and on her deathbed sought forgiveness of the congregation. And the Scottish Revolution was, by that, effectively at an end. The Treaty of Edinburgh was the success story of the Scottish Revolution. It made possible the Scottish Reformation by decreeing that the French and English troops would leave Scotland and that the Scottish Parliament would be free to determine its own affairs without interference. And they held a great service of thanksgiving. The Mass was abolished. The power of the Pope was taken away. The Reformed faith was established as the official religion of Scotland by statute law. A commission of six ministers was given the task of drawing up a confession of faith, one of which was John Knox. They finished that confession in 4 days. Yet it was remarkably clear and thorough and was used by the Scottish Church until the Westminster Confession appeared in the next century. Both this confession and the Book of Discipline, which outlined the form of government of the Church, were voted through Parliament, as Knox puts it, in free and lawful assembly. And this was in January of 1561. Well, in August of that year, Mary Queen of Scots came back and set up her French court in Edinburgh. She was 19 years old. She was witty, charming, good-looking, vivacious. But Knox was not deceived. She was intent on bringing Scotland back to the Roman fold. She was intent, once again, on using the French troops, French monarchical theory, to rule Scotland. On her first Sunday there, she had a French priest celebrate the Mass. Well, John Knox said that he feared that one Mass more than 10,000 troops. It was both illegal and a rallying point for the Romanist opposition to the Reformation. So Knox preached with power against her from the pulpit in St. Giles. And of course, Mary was offended. She called him to speak to her on four different occasions. And on each, she was amazed to find that he spoke his mind in her presence without compromise. Told her exactly what he thought. Now, Mary was, you may remember, Mary was her own worst enemy. She, within 6 years, her schemings and her caprice led her to prison, the flight to England, where she was shuffled from prison to prison, and finally Elizabeth had no choice but to have her beheaded. She constantly was trying to take over the English throne. You just couldn't stop her. And so Elizabeth finally had to put an end to her. She had one son, James VI, who would later become James I of England. We'll deal with him in just a moment. Well, Scotland was then, after she's gone, Scotland was ably ruled by the regent Moray, who was sadly assassinated in 1570, after which there was quite a bit of violence, and Knox had to be constantly on the move, on the alert. Once someone had fired a shot through his window, would have killed him if he'd been sitting in his regular seat. But he wasn't. Lord spared him. He went to St. Andrews for a while, then back to Edinburgh. Finally, a sick man, just worn out from all his labors, everything that he had been called to do in his lifetime. And he died on November 24th, 1572, just 58 years old. At his burial in St. Giles Kirk, the Earl of Morton gave him this memorial: "Here lies one who neither flattered nor feared any flesh." Now, I want to take just a moment and be sure we've got our kings and queens straight here, and you've got the last page in your notes for tonight has kind of pictures and kind of lays out the kings and queens of Scotland and England. and we need to kind of be sure that we're straight on our royalty here. Okay. Henry VIII, and I'm going to be fairly brief here because we've dealt with some of these folks in the past, and we'll deal with some of them again. Henry VIII, of course, in England, is credited with leading the break with Rome. In truth, however, his break really was political rather than spiritual. His real interest was not in reforming the church. In fact, his title, Defender of the Faith, was given to him by the Pope for a treatise that he wrote against Martin Luther. What he wanted was a divorce. The Pope wouldn't give him one, and so he said, okay, well, we won't have the Pope here. We'll have me. James V in Scotland at this time, rather than following Henry's lead and breaking with Rome to reform the Scottish church, he used his leverage to gain financially from the Pope and supported Romanism. It was under him that we come to the first of the Scottish martyrs, Patrick Hamilton. We'll look at him in a week or two. Then Edward VI in England, back again, 1547, 1553. Here we find that son that Henry VIII wanted so badly. And what Henry had started with a political break from Rome, Edward was determined to finish with the thorough reform of the church, a truly spiritual break with Rome. Edward VI started his reign at the early age of 9. He had his regents, of course, and his counselors and chaplains, but he was not inactive as a king. He wasn't just a puppet. He was truly committed to the reform of the church. When he was 14, he wrote a treatise against Romanism that was really well done, and it received the warm approval of John Calvin, no less. In fact, Calvin dedicated many of his commentaries, I think six anyway, I believe it was, to King Edward VI. Edward was taught by none other than John Knox, one of his chaplains. During his reign, there was an early and biblical prayer book prepared. Celibacy was abolished for the priests. The power of the bishops, which was the backbone of the papal power, was greatly restrained. And the Mass, which was the key to papal power, was abolished. The main problem with Edward's reign was that it was too short. After a reign of barely 6 years, this youthful gift to the Reformation fell to tuberculosis. His death so soon, at just 16, was a terrible blow to the cause of Reformation in England. If Edward had lived and reigned as long as his half-sister Elizabeth, I venture to say England would be Presbyterian today. Well, Mary the First, 1553-1558, successor to Edward VI, in the 5 years of Mary's reign, she did more harm to the cause of Reformation than Edward had done good in his six. So much so that she is remembered in history as Bloody Mary. She considered it her mission to bring England back into the fold of Rome. Reformed Christians were martyred by the hundreds. Heads fell into baskets, bodies hanged from ropes, muscles were scorched, charred, roasted by the flames. During this time, many Reformed ministers fled England to the European continent, where they made their way to places that they could worship in freedom. Many went to Geneva, where they witnessed how Reformed Christianity could function, could flourish if given liberty. Many studied with John Calvin there. They took careful note, waiting for the chance to return with this great Reformation theology to their English homeland. Unsafe in England with Bloody Mary, unwelcome in Scotland, where another Roman Catholic, Mary Queen of Scots, sat on the throne, he found a welcome in Calvin's Geneva, studying there from 1554 to 1559. That was Knox. Well, Mary Queen of Scots, 1542-1567, daughter of James V and Mary of Lorraine. Her father and mother were both Roman Catholic. Her mother was even a French Catholic. Roman Catholic Church was far more violent and corrupt in those days than it is today. Mary officially became queen when her father James V died in 1542. She was 6 days old. After a short struggle, her mother seized power as the queen regent, ruling in the place of the infant Mary. Remember, her mother's French. She placed Frenchmen in key positions in Scotland, used French troops in abundance. Romanism flourished in Scotland. She was trying to make Scotland a mere imitation of France. With the martyrdom of the old well-respected Protestant minister, the country was up in arms. We mentioned Walter Milne a few moments ago. And in 1559 and 1560, Scotland saw a revolution that drove Mary and her mother back to France. Mary, Queen of Scots, was in France from 1548 to 1561. She was an avowed papist. She thoroughly opposed the Reformation. She had a hand in persecuting it. But yet, as we saw, she was her own undoing. She married Lord Darnley, her Catholic cousin. This was bad enough. Then after his death, she married the Earl of Bothwell, who was strongly suspected of the murder of Lord Darnley. And that was just too much, as amidst general rebellion, she was deposed in favor of James VI, who was an infant at the time. She was imprisoned in Lochleven Castle, then she fled over the border into England, where her cousin Elizabeth was on the throne. Kept her in the Tower of London for years, but she couldn't stop her trying to take over the British throne. Finally, Elizabeth regretfully had her beheaded. James V ruled from 1567 to 1625 in Scotland, from 1603 to 1625 in England. James VI was a closet Catholic who swore to the covenant and yet heard the Mass on his deathbed. He had no real sympathies for the Reformation or for the Puritans. He was a shrewd politician who knew how to appease his parliaments and how to win concessions. He was slick. He allowed the translating of the King James Bible, published in 1611, allowed the Puritans to do the translation. He was the one who got to write the title page, though, King James Bible. And he would not let it be printed, you might not know this, he would not let it be printed without the Apocrypha. Those books in the Roman Catholic Bible, those apocryphal Old Testament books. The first 1611 King James Bible was printed with the Apocrypha. And for years it was a crime to print it without the Apocrypha. First ones who did, of course, were Puritans. It was his skill at appeasement and compromise that let him keep the kingdom together where his son, Charles I, couldn't. He developed that handy doctrine of the divine right of kings, borrowed from the French, and taught his son, Charles, that the king is above the law and answers to no one. Samuel Rutherford answered that one quite admirably in his little book, Lex Rex, from Scotland, which in essence talks about the divine right of law over even kings. That book was a thorn in the side of the Stuart monarchy, and for years it was the death penalty to own it. It was collected and burned. If you find a first edition Lex Rex, which Covenant College has in their rare book collection in their library, it's a very rare thing to find. Charles I, then, ruled from 1625 to 1649. Charles had all the faults of his father, but none of his winning qualities. He was stubborn. He was high-handed. He was not a skilled politician. He could never get along with Parliament, either one, Scottish or English. And he didn't seem to mind making enemies, bitter enemies. The history of Charles I in the 1640s in England is a fascinating history, and it was during this time that the Westminster Assembly wrote that great document that we still use today. Some of the greatest minds in all history were at work during that time. But our story is really in Scotland, and we have little time. So let me just say that Charles I made a dreadful mistake that cost him his life by starting a civil war in England twice. He fought his own parliament with foreign troops, and lost. He was convicted of treason and beheaded. Oliver Cromwell, who had been largely responsible for the military, succeeded him as Lord Protector and sat over a time of the most tolerant government in England in that century. Well, Charles had been doing poorly in Scotland, too. He tried to make the Church of Scotland into another Church of England, and he persecuted the Reformed churches, persecuted the Covenanters. Well, Charles II then, his dates are 1660 to 1685 in England. Scotland brought him back to the throne right after Charles I died, 1649 or 1650. Well, the Scots do have one flaw. They are fiercely loyal to their monarchy, right or wrong, almost. They were outraged. They were furious with Cromwell when Charles I was beheaded. They never recognized Cromwell as their lawful ruler. They fought Cromwell every step of the way, and they created the unfortunate spectacle of God-fearing Reformed Puritans fighting on the battlefield with God-fearing Reformed Covenanters. But the Scots are a stubborn lot, and the English can be stubborn too. Almost immediately, the Scots set about to restore the monarchy. They called Charles II to the throne of Scotland 9 years before he was finally called to the throne of England. New Year's Day, 1651, it is. He was proclaimed the King of Scotland. Well, in 1662, Charles II passed the Great Act of Uniformity, in which he demanded that every minister in England and Scotland subscribe to the now corrupted prayer book, the whole prayer book, and nothing but the prayer book. If they refused, they would lose their church, they would lose their income, they would lose their degrees, their houses, their offices, which would plunge most of them into real poverty. So in what was called the Great Ejection, one of the defining moments of English church history in 1662. In this great ejection, rather than violate their consciences, 2,000 ministers in England. And in Scotland, a comparatively larger number, 400 ministers in Scotland, gave it all up and took to preaching in the fields and the forests instead of giving in to the king. They would not violate their conscience. And so, and that event, the Great Ejection of 1662, marked essentially the end of the Puritan movement within the Church of England, because it kicked the Puritans out. It did not mark the end of Puritanism, but it did mark the end of the Puritan movement within the Church of England. Samuel Rutherford, now dying, was to be kicked out of the university. They were going to kick him out of his own bed, in fact. But when they came for him, he was on death's door, and he said, "You go tell His Majesty that I am going where few kings ever go." Then James II, 1685 to 1688, finally after the death of his brother Charles II, James II was even worse governor than Charles I, who had been beheaded. He continued to persecute the church. He mismanaged the country so badly that finally, in rebellion, the British deposed him. He fled to France, and William of Orange and his wife Mary were called to jointly take over the throne in what's called the Glorious Revolution of 1688. And what I want to do from this point is to do two things. I want to look first at the general history of the Covenanters in two succeeding time periods, from the Scottish Reformation that you already know a bit about to the Solemn League and Covenant of 1643. And then the second time period, from the Solemn League and Covenant to the Glorious Revolution in 1688. And then secondly, what I want for us to look more closely at some of the people, particularly some of the Covenanters in Scotland that make up that history. I hope to introduce you to the first and the last of the Scottish martyrs and several important people in between. There are so many people who played key roles in this covenanting history, and it grieves me that we don't have time to deal with any more of them than this. Perhaps another time. So for our general history, I think that's... you have that in your notes there. General history, first period from the Reformation, Scottish Reformation, to the Solemn League and Covenant. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here on the Reformation since we covered that material already with John Knox. I'll simply refer you to your notes on that. But now do note one very important difference between the Reformation in England and the Reformation in Scotland. In England, the real Reformation came from a grassroots movement. It came, as it were, from the bottom up. In Scotland, on the other hand, the impetus for the Reformation came mostly from the Scottish nobility. It came, as it were, from the top down. The group of Protestant leaders who assembled in 1550 to sign the National Covenant were in large measure the Scottish nobility, the rulers in the land. And so they pledged themselves to support the Reformed faith in its doctrine and its practice in the Church of Scotland. Now I know that kind of goes against the grain of what you may have been taught, that normally the historian will stand up and say, in England was reformed from the top down. Scotland was reformed from the bottom up. Well, really, it's exactly the opposite. They say, yes, they can say, yeah, well, it was King Henry VIII. Well, as we know, it wasn't King Henry VIII, and it wasn't the English nobility that were responsible for reform in England. It was from the fruit of those earlier labors of John Wycliffe and William Tyndale, growing up in town after town after town, that brought Reformation to England. And in Scotland, it really was the Scottish nobility, not the king or the queen necessarily, but the nobility were the ones who were responsible for the Reformation in Scotland. So it's kind of, I take a position a bit different from what you may have heard from other folks covering this period. Well, then we come to an extremely significant event in the history of Scotland. 1603. Queen Elizabeth in England died without leaving any heirs to the throne. That's why Virginia is called Virginia. She was the Virgin Queen. No heirs. So that marked the end of the House of Tudor in England. And so they imported James VI of Scotland to become James I of England and Scotland, the United, the Union of the Crowns. And both countries shared one king. And the Union of the Crowns is so significant because it took the episcopacy of England, with all the royal control of the church that went with it because of the bishops, and put that powerful system in the hands now of a Scottish king. So it was only a matter of time before he would want that kind of power in his native Scotland, too. It's much easier to control an Episcopal church from the top down than it is to control a Presbyterian church. You ever been to General Assembly? So in 1610, James established the system of bishops in Scotland. He became more and more impressed with the advantages of the Elizabethan compromise, and he wanted to pattern the Scottish church after this English model. James ousted all of the leading Presbyterians. He packed the General Assemblies with men favorable to his position, and in 1618 he tries to conform the pattern of worship in the Scottish Church to that of the Anglican Church with what's called the Five Articles of Perth. Well, in 1625 we have the death of James, the accession of Charles I. Charles followed his father's general policies, but he didn't have his tact and he didn't have his political ability. Matter of fact, during this time, the Scottish Reformed Church had a very rough time of it. But during these years, we do, nonetheless, even in the midst of difficulty, we find a series of powerful revivals in the church in Scotland, as well as in Ireland. John Livingstone preached at the Kirk of Shotts. Kirk is the Scottish term for church, the Church of Shotts. He didn't have the fiery temperament of John Knox, but he was rather scholarly, and he disliked controversy, but he was a true covenanter. And in the summer of 1630, he preached in the kirkyard to a vast crowd from Ezekiel 36, verses 35 and 36. He had not intended to preach. There was another minister that was going to preach, but he got sick, and so John Livingstone was called on in his place. Livingstone wanted to run away. He felt overawed at this, but he stayed, and he preached. And a small but genuine revival broke out, with over 500 people being converted from that one sermon. But then these small local revivals were in a way the exception rather than the rule. Charles kept up his anti-Presbyterian policy in Scotland. He leaned heavily on the very Anglican Archbishop Laud, who drew up a very Romanist-leaning liturgy. In 1637, Charles tried to force this liturgy on the Scots, who would have nothing of it. Matter of fact, when it was first read from the pulpit in St. Giles Kirk in Edinburgh, it was a little old lady, Jenny Gedge, who said, "You read that in my lugs?" My ears. "You read that?" And she picked up her stool and threw it at the minister, and nearly started a riot, and soon the country was ready to be in arms. In the next year, 1638, the National Covenant was renewed. Presbyterianism was reestablished, and the independence of the church from the crown was once more reasserted. You remember it was this event that led Charles to march his forces then against the Scots, and made him finally call the Parliament in England to vote him some money, because he needed money to fund the troops to march against the Scots, who were rejecting his Anglicanism. And these battles in 1639 and 1640 are what's called the First and Second Bishops' Wars, because it was fought over that crucial question of whether Charles would force bishops on the Church of Scotland. Charles said yes, Scotland said no. And so, and of course in England, that led to a whole another time. We remember that in calling the English Parliament to give him money to fight the Scots, Charles kind of got the ball rolling that led then to the First and Second Civil Wars in England, which eventually cost Charles his head, and would catapult Oliver Cromwell to the place of power in England. You remember the Puritans asked the Covenanters to help them fight Charles. And that's what brought about the Solemn League and Covenant of 1643. The Solemn League was more comprehensive than the National Covenant had been. It included in its scope all of England and Ireland, as well as Scotland. They swore to help the British in fighting Charles, swore to uphold and maintain the purity of the Reformed faith in their church with their life's blood, if necessary. The Solemn League and Covenant of 1643. So in this first civil war, the Scots unite with the English against King Charles. And it's the Solemn League and Covenant of 1643 that facilitates that. Well, then from the Solemn League and Covenant to the Glorious Revolution, I don't know if we're... No, we're not. We'll stop at that point. We'll pick up with the Solemn League and the Glorious Revolution. We'll look at three political parties next time, and then, Lord willing, next time we'll also be able to begin. Yeah, we should be able to begin looking at some of these covenanting martyrs and covenanters, key players in the history of the church in Scotland. So we will leave it there and pick up with that next time.